With the growing popularity of fitness trackers and health apps, we ask, what evidence is there that they work?
The research out there is mixed in terms of weight loss, in terms of weight loss maintenance as well. We're still learning.
We'll have experts on the line to answer your questions. If you use a fitness tracker or have questions about them, give us a call. Our number is 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Plus, Kick Butts Day events are being held across the country this week, including in Peoria, where today's school kids will learn about the effect of vaping on their bodies.
They're starting out with the e-cigarettes, and they're thinking, oh, this is so cool. It's just water vapor. I can do it anywhere. And then they are transitioning into cigarettes.
That's Dr. Kanenika Verma talking to the Peoria Journal-Star's Steve Tartar. We'll talk to her. And
3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins for the championship.
The men's NCAA basketball tournament is back. We'll talk with two sports reporters about all things March Madness. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo this week. We're hearing a lot about wearable technologies like Fitbits and step counters. Maybe you even use one yourself. I'm wearing a Garmin watch that tracks steps, among other things. With the growing popularity of fitness trackers and health apps, we thought we'd take some time on the show today to step back and ask, what evidence is there that they work, and could they be doing more harm than good? We'd love for you to join our conversation today. If you use a fitness tracker or have questions about them, give us a call. Our number is 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. To help us learn more about all of this, I'm joined on the line from Peoria by Tara Haley. She's a freelance science and health journalist and regular contributor to Forbes and NPR. I'm also joined by Nabil Al-Sharafa, assistant professor in the Departments of Preventative Medicine and Computer Science at Northwestern University. Tara, Nabil, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
You're quite welcome. I should point out that I have a Garmin Forerunner watch that I use, pretty popular in the running community. It counts steps, monitors sleep, and has a GPS tracker that helps me keep tabs on how many miles I've run and what pace I've been able to maintain. These kinds of technologies seem to be getting more popular, Tara, and I wonder if you can help us get a sense of how many people are using these kinds of wearable fitness trackers.
I don't have hard numbers on me, but I know that the Fitbit, for example, somewhere around 10 to 15% of the population has a Fitbit, which is a pretty substantial number. And they kind of follow the same pattern that you do with a lot of other new technologies. They have the early adopters who jump on the train right away, and then over time it gradually, you know, increases a bit. And then you have kind of this, you know, tipping point where other people are like, oh, wow, this is cool. And then a lot more people start buying them. I was in that last part. I am wearing a Fitbit as well right now, and I look at it for sleep and for steps. But it's definitely a growing interest, and the app industry in particular is growing even faster. I think the developers have been on this for a while, and I think it's somewhere around 145,000 health apps out there. So it's a pretty substantial number of opportunities out there too. But with that number, you're also going to have a lot of crap among the good stuff.
Sure. You mentioned the growth in apps, especially. You know, I'm wondering if you can give us a brief overview of some of the different tracker options that are out there and what people use them for.
Yeah. Well, there's the Fitbit Type ones. There's a lot of those, which are just they're tracking your steps and your sleep. And there's a lot of different versions of sleep trackers and wearables that track your steps. And that started even with, you know, the iPhone itself started tracking steps even before the wearables became too super popular, at least. But then there's also specialized ones. So, for example, there's been one app that tried to develop that tries to take your blood pressure, although it turns out it doesn't do a very good job of that. On the other hand, there's another one that tries to monitor heart palpitations, and a recent study found it was comparable to a 14-day event monitor. There's ones for pregnancy. There's a ton for pregnancy, actually, all different kinds of things, helping, you know, you count baby steps and baby kicks and breastfeeding and trying to communicate with your doctor. So there's a lot of opportunities there. Apps that try and help you change a behavior, such as quit smoking, or simply move more. I would personally put Pokemon Go in the move more one, but, you know. so there's pretty much any kind of health behavior or health condition you can think of, there's an app for that. I mean, as they say.
Sure. We posted on our Facebook page asking listeners about their experiences with fitness trackers, and Elizabeth wrote that she's been using a Fitbit since Christmas that helps her keep aware of her activity level. Dorothy also chimed in to say that she appreciates the reminders to get up and move if she's been sitting at her desk for too long. Terry, you mentioned that you use a Fitbit, but you've said you use it with a grain of salt. I'm curious what you mean by that.
Well, we don't have a lot of good information yet on the accuracy of all of these devices, but we're getting more and more each day. And there's been several studies that have shown that Fitbits, for example, and I don't know if it's specifically Fitbits, but I think they were among the ones studied, that they're not the greatest at tracking sleep. They give you a general sense of it. But if I were to look at my Fitbit, you know, right up in the morning and say, oh, okay, I had exactly 5.3 hours of sleep and I was awake at this time and I was awake at that time. Okay, I need to go back to bed for 3 hours. That may or may not be precisely the time that I was actually asleep. It's judging it based on movement for the most part. And, you know, I can be perfectly still when I'm watching a movie and it thinks I'm asleep. On the other hand, I have fallen asleep on a plane during a long distance flight for 3 hours and my Fitbit thought I was wide awake the whole time. So, you have to consider the fact that these are computers that are still in the early stages of developing algorithms to track really complex autonomic processes in the human body. Our human bodies are pretty complex machines themselves. So for any kind of other electronic to keep up, it's going to take us a while to get there.
Sure. Nabil, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. As Tara pointed out, there are some research studies that show these apps can be effective, but other researchers have been speaking out against them. I'm curious, your thoughts on these products. Is there evidence that they work the way that they claim to?
Yeah, well, no, definitely. Thank you again for having me on. There still remains a lot that we do not know about existing fitness trackers, as Tara mentioned. I mean, recent studies have come out, for example, from Singapore and recently the University of Pittsburgh, that have shown that fitness trackers were not as effective at weight loss and weight loss maintenance. However, we know they are effective at encouraging people to take more steps, but whether these steps necessarily translate to weight loss is another story. And so I think we're always looking for a silver bullet or, you know, the magic Fitbit or the magic device. We should not be so naive to think that, simply a gadget is going to change a lifestyle habit that has evolved over so many years, right? And so a lot of times, what we tend to focus on as engineers and computer scientists in medicine is working with behaviorists and interventionists to really design a system, right? So it's not just purely about the gadget, but also about the behavioral change technique, right? There are so many factors that play into changing behavior, as Tara mentioned. You know, behavior is complex. It's developed over many, many years. And so what we're really trying to understand here is how do these devices and the outputs from these devices coupled with behavioral change techniques and whether these, when they're coupled, whether they're actually produce successful outcomes such as weight loss and weight loss maintenance.
Sure. One of the researchers that you mentioned is Greg Hager at Johns Hopkins University. He went as far as to say that these apps are causing problems because they take a one-size-fits-all approach. He's referring in part to the Fitbit, which sets a step goal for users of 10,000 steps per day. Nabil, do we know where that number came from?
The 10,000 steps. There has been research in terms of mapping and recommendations from several agencies that recommend, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity a week. So we do, and that, and that translates to, and so some have translated that to 10,000 steps. But the reality is we're, when we're talking about a one-size-fits-all approach, the reality is we're very different, right? And what motivates you might not necessarily be the same factor that motivates me. And, the Precision Medicine Initiative recently announced by our previous president acknowledges that there is variability in everyone's environment, lifestyle, and also our genes, right? And so perhaps one size might not fit all, but maybe one size can fit some people, and maybe perhaps a few sizes can fit all, or at least many, right? And I think that's the promise of wearable technology, to really help us group and cluster people into different groups and categories and design successful interventions around these groups.
Sure. Should point out as well that there are some ways to fool these devices into thinking that you've taken steps when you haven't. So we got a Facebook comment from Christine in Urbana who said she was having some step count competitions with her dad, only to find out that he had been cheating by shaking his wrist compulsively so it would raise his step count. So obviously it goes back to the old saying many of us have heard, when you cheat, you only cheat yourself. Tara, in your writing and coverage of this issue, are you finding that people are maybe cheating the system a little bit?
I think there's probably some people will have this compulsion to do it because they're the type of people who can rationalize, well, you know, I really will end up taking this many steps and I'll forget to have my Fitbit on at the time. So I'm just doing what I would have done anyway. Or, you know, I think that it's more of a rationalization that'll sometimes happen. I wanted to actually, if you don't mind, to speak to the 10,000 steps.
Sure.
While that number is kind of arbitrary, I think one thing to note is that when you encourage anyone to meet any number of additional steps that they might not already be taking, and it's working, I mean, if it's actually a motivating factor, as Nabil pointed out, then you're still improving their physical activity for the day. So even if 10,000 steps is not necessarily the ideal number of steps that, you know, person A should be taking that day, if it's more the step, you know, if they normally take 4,000 steps and in trying to get to 10,000, they take 7,000 steps, that's still more physical activity. And it's not going to have a huge impact on weight loss, because weight loss is going to require, you know, both a diet and and additional exercise. But it can have an impact on things like reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes or heart disease or other things, which exercise alone, even without the dietary interventions, which obviously would help if they were there, can actually help. So I think it's a little bit alarmist to say that these apps are doing more harm than good. It kind of reminds me of the days when TV started, and of course TV was going to destroy our country and, you know, destroy our culture and everything. And every technology comes with opportunities and drawbacks, and it's a balance of the two that's important.
Sure. Nabil, can you help us understand your approach to creating technologies that are effective at changing behavior and how you go about doing that by bringing together computer scientists with health professionals and behavioral scientists?
Yeah. So I get much of our, you know, existing behavioral research right now is often studied through self-report. So, you know, aside from tracking physical activity, currently the only passive sensing technology measure accepted as the gold standard is for the detection of physical activity is the actigraph. But when it comes to other measures, such as stress, emotion, depression, diet, all these other things, there's still no standard passive sensing technology. So I still have to ask you, for example, how much did you eat yesterday? And, you know, were you stressed during this period of time or not, to really establish, you know, really understand someone's behavior. And so in our lab, the Habits Lab, our ultimate goal is to design mHealth systems, wireless and mHealth systems or mobile health systems that are smart and effective, but also help us to study people passively, right? So without disrupting them with several questions, in order to really help us understand human behavior more objectively. Right. And so currently our lab's focused a lot on dietary intake and eating habits. And I think what's unique about our lab is we're an engineering and computer science lab that's housed in the School of Medicine at Northwestern. And so we have a unique opportunity to really work closely with behaviorists and medical researchers to learn from them, which we hope will translate to designing more effective systems. And so we like to think of our lab as a bridge between computer science and medicine.
Interesting. Before we say goodbye, we've just got a couple minutes left. I'd like to hear from each of you just some general advice to people who are considering buying a wearable tech item with the hopes of improving their health. And I would imagine some of that depends on the goals they have. Tara, we'll start with you.
Yeah, my first recommendation is actually to talk to your doctor about it. You know, your doctor is going to have he might not be up on all the research on this, but he's going to know what you most likely will personally need to do to improve your health. And so you can talk to him about things. And then second, I would say to take it with a grain of salt, as I noted before. And you might do a little bit of research to see, is there actually a peer-reviewed study out there that shows what this does, that shows how validated these measures are? And finally, I would say don't make the device your master. You are still the master of the device. In other words, I would encourage people to be wary of becoming a slave to the device where it's like, oh my gosh, it says 10,000 steps and I have 9,000. I don't feel good, but I'm going to have to go outside and walk another 1,000 steps just to meet it. You want to make simultaneously use it to change your behavior and incorporate it into your existing life. So it's everything in moderation and with a balance, I guess.
Sure. And Nabil, just quickly in about 30 seconds, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, well, it's important that people like it, right? And that, you know, fashion remains an important part of the game, right? So my advice is make sure it's something you're willing to wear continuously. I think that's one of the issues when it comes to studying is making sure that people will wear these devices continuously, right? That's why we study battery lifetime and look and feel. And also, you know, Tara kind of summed it up really well, but I'd also add...
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there, Nabil, but we're out of time. Tara Haley, a freelance science and health journalist, Nabil Al-Sharafa, an assistant professor at Northwestern University. Thanks, both of you, for being with us today on The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st today. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. A program in Peoria uses virtual reality to show kids the effect of smoking from the inside out. It's taking place tonight as part of Kick Butts Day, a national campaign for tobacco-free kids. And this year, the program includes a discussion about the hazards of e-cigarettes and vaping. I'm joined now on the line from Peoria by one of the organizers of tonight's event. Dr. Kaninika Verma is a pulmonary critical care and sleep physician at the Illinois Lung and Critical Care Institute, which is part of OSF St. Francis Medical Center. Dr. Verma, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Tonight, you and other organizers are hosting students from fourth grade through high school. They'll get a chance to virtually fly through lungs and other parts of the body using games that the OSF engineers and staff came up with. What's the goal of tonight's event?
The goal of tonight is to promote activism and empower youth to stand out, speak up, and seize control against big tobacco. As cigarettes, we all know, are not very good for us, but it is interesting how even today, you know, more than 3,000 kids under the age of 18 try smoking for the first time, and about 700 kids become regular daily smokers. So, and tobacco is still the leading cause of preventable death in the U.S., which kills more than 480,000 people per year. So we want kids to stand out and speak up and recognize the hazards and badness of tobacco.
In addition to have this sort of magic school bus virtual experience flying through the body, what other activities will students get to participate in?
So right now, tonight, we are going to have a bunch of different stations that show what the effects of smoking are on the body. We have a whole jar of tar. We are going to have a pig lung, which shows a normal lung and what happens after tobacco, which also shows lung cancer, what happens to the mouth, and, of course, the virtual reality program.
Yeah. This year in the Kick Butts Day in Peoria, you're also focusing on the effect of vaping on our bodies.
Yes.
What would you say the most surprising thing is that comes up when you talk with kids and teenagers about e-cigarettes?
What's alarming, actually, is that most kids think that this is safe. This is just water vapor. It's safe. Also, that it's good for you. So when we went to the past few years, we've gone to a lot of the elementary school children from third, fourth, fifth graders to talk about vaping. And they actually told us that, oh, I have this older sibling or older family member or friend who vapes, and it's cool, it's safe, it comes in multiple different flavors. So that is very, very alarming to us. As we know, e-cigarettes or vaping in young kids actually leads to later on cigarette and more tobacco use.
So it acts as kind of a gateway, I guess, then, yeah, from the vaping to tobacco?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And vaping in itself is not safe. And that is a very big misconception and misnomer that it is safe. It is not safe.
What are the hazards specifically of vaping or e-cigarettes?
Well, first of all, it's the vaping. It actually lights a liquid flame, chemical, which in turn turns into a vapor and goes inhaled into the lungs. So you have a higher temperature. You have that can actually cause damage inside of the airway. Also, those chemicals that are in the liquid by itself can cause lung damage. Some of the components actually can cause scarring of the lung over time, and not to even mention that they can explode and burn. On top of that, they have nicotine, which of course we all know is very bad and causes damage throughout the body. So it is not safe.
Where do you think some of the misconceptions about vaping come from?
I think a lot of it comes from a lot of commercials, and a lot of people don't see the smoke or smell the smoke, so they think it's safe. And especially with all the commercials that are out there saying it's just water vapor, and it's people can hide it. You know, there's nobody really knows that if somebody is actually vaping or using nicotine, because nobody can smell it, nobody can see it, and people can be in any indoor facility and nobody really knows that they're doing this.
There are some cases where vaping can be of help, for example, to help get a person off of cigarettes. Is that right?
So there are, yes, and that's one of the things we do talk with our patients about, is that if you're actually smoking cigarettes and you want to use these e-cigarettes as a gateway to completely getting off of tobacco and nicotine, that is great. So we do recommend, you know, we do recommend our patients to try for that, but it is not a replacement. It is not a safer way of getting nicotine, because there's no such thing as a safe nicotine.
Sure, and this is where it gets a little tricky. How do you help students understand that there could be some benefits of vaping if someone's already a smoker, but it's not a good idea for them to take up e-cigarettes on their own?
Well, we talk to them, and that is, and I'll, we discuss with them. We show them the badness that vaping causes, and trying to tell them that this is not something you want to start. If this is something that somebody already is smoking and wants to get off of tobacco, then that is fine. But it is what we call lesser of two evils. It is still bad.
Sure. Do you think there are some efforts being made right now to have some better regulations to protect kids from the effects of vaping?
I think there's been call for the FDA to start regulating it. Now, over the past 5 years since we've been doing kick butts here in Peoria, is initially when we first started talking about vaping, there were no rules. Anybody could go out and buy e-cigarettes. But now that there are rules in place, I think now you have to be 18 to purchase this. And there's been now call for the FDA to start regulating it.
Sure. And what advice do you have for parents about how to talk to their kids about vaping and e-cigarettes?
Same way we talk about regular cigarettes with them. We need to tell them that these are pretty much synonymous, that the dangers of picking up a cigarette and lighting up is the same as you turning on a vape or an e-cigarette. Those dangers don't go away, and there's even, depending on what's in the liquid, there can be even more harmful effects to the lung and cause more lung injury.
And in the time that you've been working on this project, Dr. Verma, have you seen really a large uptick in e-cigarettes and vaping?
I have, for my patient population, yes, I have. And we do talk to our patients, because some of my patients have come in and told me, well, I don't smoke cigarettes anymore, and I'm doing vaping, which is safer for me, which is good for me. So we have seen that, but we have had to have a discussion with them that it is not safe, that this is a gateway to come off.
Sure. So, and what would you say has changed in terms of messaging to kids these days? You know, whether it's from outside, you know, outside influences, or whether it's from people like yourself trying to educate kids, what has changed in terms of messaging about smoking to young people?
I think the big change has been coming. What has changed is that people have recognized regular cigarettes as a bad thing, but now things, the thought is that e-cigarettes are safe, and so realizing big tobacco is actually backing a lot of these vaping products, and that realizing that this is a gateway to get new smokers. In 2014, about 12.6% of U.S. adults had tried e-cigarettes, and about 3.7% of adults use e-cigarettes daily. So we know that there's a market. We know this is a way to get people hooked on.
Sure. I'm wondering if you could kind of enlighten us on, you know, what it takes to put on an event like this. It sounds like, you know, all these great demonstrations and everything for kids here tonight. What kind of work goes into putting this together?
It's a big team effort, I'll tell you that. We have been very fortunate to be able to partner up with JUMP, Simulation and Training Lab here at St. Francis Medical Center. And it has been incredible to the staff that we have with engineers, our storyboard writers, our own cancer prevention team here. It's a whole team effort that gets pulled together to sit down and to pull something like this off. And we're very, very excited.
Dr. Kanitika Verma is a pulmonary critical care and sleep physician at OSF St. Francis Medical Center. I'm one of the organizers of an event to educate children and teens about the dangers of smoking and vaping. The event is taking place at the JUMP Simulation and Education Center in Peoria tonight, starting at 6 p.m. We'll tweet out some more information and also have that information available on our website. Dr. Verma, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Those were students at Northwestern after they learned on Sunday that their team will be playing in the NCAA men's basketball tournament for the first time ever. The Wildcats are the only team from Illinois in this year's tournament, which tips off today with the first four games over in Dayton, Ohio. Joining us to talk all things March Madness is WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout and Chicago Tribune sports writer Teddy Greenstein. Cheryl and Teddy, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem.
My pleasure.
Great to have you both with us. Cheryl, we'll start with you. I know you were at Northwestern on Selection Sunday. What was the atmosphere like there at Welsh Ryan Arena?
It was so unique because you had such an anticipation. Everyone knew it was going to happen, but still watching the crowd, it was a mixture of students, young kids, much older people. You know, alumni were there. You had the team there. They're all brought in one by one with announcements. They had the big screen. You had the band playing. It was really a very celebratory atmosphere, and it was fitting because they deserved it. And Chris Collins definitely has just worked magic with this team.
Yeah, and Teddy, you were there as well, and as I understand it, you're a Northwestern alum, right?
That's right. They were 0-18 in the Big Ten my freshman year.
Oh, man, they've come a long way. Come a long way. How does it feel this week to see your team in the tournament?
It's been fun. I mean, I've covered so many losing teams, so many NIT teams, a lot of NIT bubble teams, that this season was a joy. You know, it was interesting because going into the year, this was not deemed the one where this was going to be the breakthrough year. Vic Law was coming off surgery. Scotty Lindsey wasn't really good last year. So it was unexpected, and that's, you know, certainly makes it even more fun. Like when the football team went to the Rose Bowl, when you don't know it's coming, and it happens, it's even more enjoyable.
Sure, and Teddy, I know you profiled the Northwestern coaching staff this week. How did this group, led by the head coach Chris Collins, take Northwestern somewhere that they've never gone before?
Yeah, good question. Chris went in, and his first hire was his high school coach, the guy who coached him at Glenbrook North, and that's Brian James, and he's an NBA veteran. And then beyond that, Chris wanted to find a former Northwestern player. So he hired Pat Baldwin, who was a point guard in the early to mid-90s, actually, when I was there. And Pat is just a super solid guy, somebody you can count on, works 20 hours a day, they say, you know, he really has an expertise in defense and point guard play. And then they rounded out their staff with a guy named Armon Gates, who had coached at Loyola. So he's the juice guy. He's the energy guy. He's the one who gets everybody pumped up. So it's a good staff, and they all bring something different to the table.
Sure. Cheryl, back to you here for just a moment. I guess just give us the breakdown. You know, where are the Cats headed? Tell us a little bit about their first-round matchup.
Well, it's interesting for them. They have to go out west. They have to go to Salt Lake City, and they have to play Vanderbilt. And Vanderbilt, is what's fun about this, and Teddy can talk about this too, is the fact that these are two of the most highly achieved academic schools to be meeting in a tournament game. But it's going to be interesting for Northwestern to handle a 7-foot three-point shooter in Lou Cornette. And also they have a really good three-point shooter in Riley Lachance. So it's going to be a tough matchup at first. And the fact is that Vanderbilt has won 7 of their last 9 games, and Northwestern has had some stumbles along the way going into this tournament. They did play some good games in the Big Ten tournament, but this is going to be a tough matchup. But I think it's going to be exciting, and looming after that is going to be Gonzaga, which is a team that's favored to win the tournament.
Sure, and yeah, Teddy, just your thoughts on that first-round matchup against Vanderbilt and how far the Cats can go in this tournament.
Yeah, Cheryl had a good scouting report. Man, he knows more about it more about Vandy than I do right now. But, you know, a little more big picture, the coach there is Bryce Drew, who had tremendous success at Valparaiso, both as a player and a coach, and got Valpo to the tournament many times. And Jim Phillips actually interviewed him before he offered the job to Chris Collins. Those Chris and Bryce are similar guys, are the same age. You know, they both were accomplished college players and all that. So found some interesting parallels there. No doubt it'll be a tough one. You know, I mean, Vanderbilt actually has the most losses of any at-large team in NCAA tournament history. They've already lost 15 games. The good news for Northwestern is they did lose a bunch in the final 6 weeks, but that was largely because Scotty Lindsey had mono, and then it came back really slowly. And in two of these three Big Ten tournament, the big three of Law, Lindsey, and McIntosh all played well. So if they can get at least two of those three guys shooting the ball well, I think Northwestern is going to win.
Okay, and Teddy, I think one of the concerns that's been expressed about this Northwestern team this season is depth. I think you saw that when Lindsey was out with mono. Is this the type of team where, you know, some foul trouble, maybe an injury, could really trip them up?
It actually shouldn't be a problem in the tournament because you just play so infrequently. You know, they've had a bunch of days off now, so then they'll play Thursday. If they win, it's Saturday, and then, I mean, hey, if you get into the Sweet 16, then you're on adrenaline. It doesn't matter. But, you know, whereas a conference tournament, Northwestern was completely gassed playing their third game in 3 days. And that third game came only like 16 hours after the previous one. Once you get into the NCAAs, it's not as big an issue. So as long as, you know, they've got Derek Pardon and Sanjay Lumpkin kind of as their bigs, they got a pretty good backup there in Barrett Benson. You don't want to have to use Benson more than like 15, 18 minutes, but they should be okay.
All right, very good. We're talking about NCAA March Madness with Cheryl Ray Strout, sports contributor at WBEZ in Chicago. Also talking with Teddy Greenstein, sports writer for the Chicago Tribune, who covers college sports and is a Northwestern alum. We'll continue our conversation on NCAA March Madness with Cheryl and Teddy coming up right after this break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. Brian Moline sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We're talking March Madness with Cheryl Ray Stout, sports contributor with WBEZ, and Teddy Greenstein, sports writer for the Chicago Tribune. Cheryl, one of the notable snubs from this year's March Madness, one of the last teams out, was Illinois State, who, despite going 27-6 this year, playing in the NIT instead. Cheryl, how are they taking that down in Bloomington Normal?
Well, not well. Their head coach, Dan Mueller, he's upset, and I don't blame him. I mean, the fact is, the problem is when you are in a mid-major and this conference decides not to really challenge and have big opponents, they have issues when it comes down to the tournament. And the way the tournament process goes, you have all these conference winners get all these slots, and so the at-large bids are very minimal, and they were snubbed as far as they're concerned. In fact, their coach actually sent out a tweet to a lot of the big teams wanting to say, hey, put me on your schedule for next year, and some of them are going to do it. So they're going to be hosting the NIT game. They're going to be a number one seed tomorrow night. They're going to be playing University of California, Irvine. So they can make some hay in that type of tournament. It's just not the NCAA.
Yeah, sure. And Teddy, I'm curious your perspective on kind of the mid-major versus high-major argument. You know, you think it's better for the tournament to have a team like an Illinois State who had a really, you know, good regular season record-wise, or is it better to have, you know, a team like a Wake Forest or a Kansas State who, you know, struggled a little bit during their conference season?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think 99% of America says bring in the mid-majors. The thing is, if you're trying to be consistent in how you judge these teams, you know, you can't. It's hard to take a team like Illinois State then that might have, I believe they're 2-4 against the RPI top 100. So, but then it's the argument of, well, wait a second, if nobody's going to play them, how are they going to get, you know, top 100 RPI wins? And they went 17-1 in the Valley. Now, I can't say I watched a lot of Missouri Valley basketball this year. You know, in past years, that's a strong league. So you would think that, you know, if the Big Ten is getting seven teams in, there should be enough room for, say, two from a conference like that.
Sure. And, of course, another team in the NIT this week is the University of Illinois. They've got a coaching change that's underway with John Gross being fired over the weekend. Yeah, Teddy, I don't think it was a real big surprise that, you know, that John Gross was let go after missing the NCAA tournament for four straight years. What do you think Illinois needs to find in their next head coach?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you certainly need a guy who's going to work his tail off. You make different hires. You know, the Lovie Smith one, I think, was certainly an upgrade over what Illinois had before, because it brings a lot of credibility. But the question with Lovie, when you're an older guy who's been in the pros, is how hard are you going to work recruiting-wise? You know, he's already made his money. He's had huge success in life. You know, when Northwestern hired Chris Collins, it's his first job and his reputation's on the line. And if he fails, you know, that's a big deal. So you have to get a guy who doesn't look at this job as, oh, I've already made it, so now I'm going on to Illinois, kind of like what DePaul did when it hired Oliver Purnell. Get a guy who it means everything to. It's his entire livelihood and his career on the line, and is going to just attack recruiting every day.
Let's take a little broader look at the NCAA tournament bracket for a moment. Cheryl, I'm curious if you see any teams in this year's bracket who might have lucked out on seeding, or maybe somebody who kind of got the short end of the stick in terms of their seed and their place in the bracket.
Well, I think Minnesota got a pretty nice high bid for themselves. I thought them getting a high one was pretty unusual, but I think the tournament was looking at the fact that they had some really good solid wins down the stretch. It was positive for them. When I look at it, I think they do a pretty good job of it. I always find it interesting, though, where they send them. I can imagine right now if you're going to the East Coast to try to play a game with all that snow coming on, so it may be favorable to Northwestern to be going the other way to the West, because at least they're getting away from the snow out there. But I think they did a pretty good job when you look at the balance of the way they seeded the teams.
Yeah, Teddy, how about you? Anybody who got really overseeded, underseeded in this year's tournament field?
Yeah, I mean, just keeping it in the Big Ten. Minnesota's a five was shocking. Wisconsin as an eight was really surprising. People thought the Badgers would be more like a six. And, you know, Michigan wins the Big Ten tournament four games in 4 days and is only a seven. It goes to show what we've always
suspected, these conference tournaments really don't mean that much when it comes to seeding, especially the Big Ten one, which is played late in the day. So, you know, it's nice that Michigan won that, but there wasn't much reward there.
Sure, and Teddy, we'll stick with you here for just a second. You know, do you see any clear favorite to really win this whole thing this year? And I'm curious as well if you've already filled out your bracket. Who's your champ?
Yeah, I spent about 4 minutes. It was
four whole minutes. All right,
four whole minutes. Actually, it's probably even less than that. I got back Sunday from the event at Welsh Ryan. I had to write 3 stories, and then I had to make all these predictions. And I just kind of I spent no time. I mean, I ended up picking Duke to go all the way. I also have UCLA in the Final Four. I know I have Michigan, although the next day I'm like, man, I should have picked Purdue coming out of there instead of Michigan. So. I have really, you know, I have all these friends who think I have this insight. Oh, help me with my bracket. And I'm like, dude, you're better off just trying it yourself. You know, I think Duke has a lot of momentum and people thought that team was going to be really good. And then midseason, they were only ranked in the 20s and now they're coming together. So I'd say Duke, you also got to look at Kentucky and UCLA as just massively talented teams.
Sure. Cheryl, how about you? Who do you have winning it all?
I like Gonzaga. I think that they go 9 deep. I think it's a team that, they've played well. They've beaten some really top opponents. So I look at them, and that's why I think, you know, Northwestern is going to be one game. They're going to get one win, but I think Gonzaga is going to be a team that's going to run the table.
Okay. The first week of the tournament, of course, is all about the upsets. Everybody in their office pool trying to figure out which 12 seed is going to beat a 5 or, you know, or which, 10 or 8 seed could get all the way to the Sweet 16. Cheryl, I'll start with you. Any particular upset picks you're watching this week?
Oh, I think Middle Tennessee is going to upset Minnesota. I think that 12 is going to take down the 5.
All right. Very good. How about you, Teddy?
That's a great one. I totally agree with it. Also, Florida Gulf Coast, I think, is playing, Florida State. That's a popular one. So I'll stick with those two.
All right, very good. And I'm curious, maybe of some of the big boys, who do you think might have the most to prove this year? One team that comes to mind for me is Kansas. You know, they're a team that enjoys regular season success every year. I think maybe 13 or 14 straight conference titles. But with one exception where they won a national title, I think, in 2008, they haven't had a lot of luck in March. Cheryl, any big guys that have something to prove this year?
I think you're right on target with that. I think Bill Self has got to win more than he has because, you know, they don't take it well down in Kansas. And they've got some big-time players. When you got big-time players, you got to have big-time moments in the tournament, and they haven't done it.
Yeah, how about you, Teddy?
I get to address that, too. Yeah, I actually went down to Lawrence for the first time in my life and saw a game there. I saw him rally to beat Baylor when I think Kansas was third ranked and Baylor was second. The atmosphere in the gym at the Fog, as they call it, was absolutely incredible. And it's totally true. I mean, when you've got Josh Jackson, who is, you know, an NBA guy playing, and plus you got Frank Mason, who some people think is the college player of the year on your roster, you got to produce. You know, it's been a weird Kansas team in that they've had a lot of off the court stuff. And I don't think that bodes well when you've just had, you know, punishments and suspensions and questions and issues. And so it might be the most talented team out there, but based on all the kind of rancor they've had during the season, I will not be picking them.
All right. Very interesting. And I'm curious as well, every year we see some players who maybe step to the front of the stage who haven't got as much attention during the regular season. Teddy, I guess, you know, we'll ask a little bit about Northwestern. Certainly, you know, Big Ten fans might be familiar with some of their players, but who are the guys leading the way for the Wildcats this week?
Yeah, I mean, keep an eye on the point guard, Bryant McIntosh. He's a third-year guy. He's from the state of Indiana. Excellent player. I mean, you know, he's a pretty good three-point shooter, hits a lot of these floaters, a lot of good passes, good assist guy. Vic Law is a spectacular athlete. He's a wing guy, went to St. Rita when he's playing well. You know, he has flashes of NBA ability. Scotty Lindsey, as mentioned, really good scorer. And then, you know, we can't diss Derek Barden, you know, the hero from the Michigan game. He knows exactly who he is. He's 6'8". He never shoots outside of, you know, maybe 12 feet from the rim. Good inside game, good little hook shots, and an excellent defender.
And, Cheryl, maybe some players you're keeping an eye on this week in the NCAA tournament.
Well, I got to add on to what Teddy said. I got to add on Charlie Hall because he's got the best rooting section of any player in the tournament. And if people don't know it, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus is his mom and Brad Hall is his dad. So that's the one everybody – I think everybody's going to watch them in the tournament.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's something to keep an eye on this week is, I guess, kind of the celebrity factor. You know, Teddy, you know, we mentioned that you're a Northwestern alum, but there are a lot of prominent sports journalists nationally that are Northwestern graduates. They've got quite the cheering section this week, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Somebody's asking me, you know, who has no interest in who's kind of a neutral party, who they should root for, Northwestern or Vandy. I said, come on, we got Mike Wilbon and they got Skip Bayless. I mean, that should be an easy one right there. But, you know, we've also got, I mean, Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and Rachel Nichols and Jay Adonde and Mike Greenberg. And on it goes. And I think America is going to start to get sick of all of us being happy. But, you know, when it's the first time in 79 years, I think we have the right to celebrate a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. No question about that. You know, I'd certainly be remiss if I didn't also mention the women's NCAA basketball tournament. The UConn Huskies have won 107 straight games, along with the last four national titles. Cheryl, any chance somebody knocks them off this year?
No, they're the Harlem Globetrotters to the Washington Generals. They are just dominant. I was talking to somebody in the women's coaching staff at DePaul, and they go, you know what, this is a team that has all WNBA players. They're so dominant. I have to mention, though, DePaul is going again for their 15th straight season to the tournament, and they're ranked number 7. They're going to be playing in Mississippi, and they're a really good team, but nobody can match what they can do out in UConn.
All right, very good. Teddy, I know you're going out to Salt Lake with the Wildcats this weekend. What are the other games out there? Who else do you get to see other than Northwestern?
Yeah, the Zags are playing. Arizona is out there. I know St. Mary's. So a lot of those good Western teams, and should make for a fine weekend.
Yeah, it should indeed. March Madness, always a good time. Well, Cheryl Ray Stout and Teddy Greenstein, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st and helping us break down our brackets.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Just tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Just search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you would like to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Dalahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Tackle direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yun and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Thanks so much for joining us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.